When I think of a good movie, I think of one that's going to grab your attention and hold you through the entire presentation. Love story, drama, comedy, action, whatever. The kind of movie that no matter how much you might need to get up to go to the bathroom, you ignore that because you don't want to miss anything. Many movies are fictional. Others are based on an actual event, but what you're watching is not at all what took place in reality. Then there are some that are extremely accurate and get the praise from the history crowd. But there's another option, I think. Is it fair to also say that a movie can be accurate in the mind of the director and those who wrote it? Accurate according to an opinion of one or many. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. Come with me, would you, to Dealey Plaza. It's a loud patch of land on the western end of downtown Dallas. The streets feed downtown from the highways nearby, and the highways nearby from downtown. As a tourist, you get annoyed with those charging down the street headed to the highway. As a driver, you get annoyed with the tourists, who are always walking around the street like it's the Abbey Road crosswalk in England. If you're in the middle of a conversation in Dealey Plaza, and an ambulance comes by, sirens blaring, you might develop a headache, the echoing is so severe. The constant sound of trains over the triple underpass makes it challenging to hear as well. It's an echo chamber, really. A wall of brick and concrete buildings along the northeast to southeast side, and of course traffic moving in both directions, funneling from a three-block width area, narrowing into that underpass. Now let's add another layer of sound to Dealey Plaza, as some have only heard it and seen it. This. Oliver Stone's 1991 movie, JFK. I jumped over something significant when going through the timeline and what probably would have fit between episodes 3 and 4. Between the release of the Warren Commission report in 1964 and the first showing of the Zapruder film on national television in 1975. An investigation into the Kennedy assassination in the late 1960s by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. Garrison launched his own investigation into the assassination and tried to link it to a plot that started in New Orleans. He focused on a man named David Ferry, and also a respected businessman in the city, Clay Shaw. Garrison was allowed a 30-minute program on NBC to give a response to an NBC report. These were his opening words.
Tonight I'm going to talk to you about truth and about fairy tales, about justice and about injustice. In the months to follow, you're going to learn that many of the things which some of the major news agencies have been telling you are untrue. You're going to learn that although you are citizens of the United States, information concerning the cause of the death of your president has been withheld from you. In the months to come, you will learn to your own satisfaction that President Kennedy was not killed by a lone assassin. You will learn that there has been and continues to be a concerted effort to keep you from learning these facts. And you will learn, I assure you, that what I have been trying to tell you and what I'm telling you tonight is true.
Best-selling author and conspiracy believer Robert Groden gives his argument on the trial.
Jim's strong case, his strongest case, was against David Ferry. When David Ferry died, was killed or committed to whatever, they claim it was a natural death. It wasn't. When he died, then Jim's only case, the only lead he had, was against Clay Shaw. I personally believe Clay Shaw is guilty as hell. Can I prove it? No, I can't. But he did lie under oath at tremendous risk about his connections to the Central Intelligence Agency. The only thing that got him off of the trial is that Jim couldn't prove that he was connected to the CIA. The jury was convinced that there was, in fact, a conspiracy, that the CIA was involved in that conspiracy, but Jim could not prove that Clay Shaw was, in fact, connected directly to the CIA. We found out from Richard Helms later on during the House Assassinations Committee hearings that, in fact, Shaw was a CIA agent and asset.
If you do an online search about Clay Shaw and the CIA, you'll find information from a very unlikely source. The CIA's own .gov website. Buried in the online library of publications is a lengthy article by author and journalist Max Holland, stating that former CIA director Richard Helms gave a deposition in a libel case where he said Shaw was a part-time businessman contact within the domestic contact division. This is said to have been the case between 1948 and 1956. The jury found Clay Shaw not guilty, but that was not the last of it. The trial was the basis for the Oliver Stone movie. Jim Garrison, played by Kevin Costner, in this clip of the movie.
But someday, somewhere, someone may find out the damn truth. We better. We better, or we might just as well build ourselves another government. Like the Declaration of Independence says to when the old one ain't working, just a little farther out west.
Not everyone's a fan of the movie.
Well, they had a few things correct. He got the city right to where it happened, and he got the person he killed right.
Dallas Police Detective Jim Lavelle says he worked with movie producers on some portions.
He'd asked me how a scene was done and what happened at this, and I'd set it up for him to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah, this was the Oswald shooting scene that you did?
Any other than the basement and stuff like that. I'd set him up for him. And then he'd change it. And he'd say, well, what do you think about that? And I said, well, if you're shooting a movie, I guess it's all right, but if you're trying to portray something that actually happened, I said, it ain't worth a damn, because that didn't happen. He said, well, it makes a better picture this way. I said, well, if that's what you're making, fine. That's what happened. They changed everything around.
The movie stretches through Garrison's investigation and concludes at the trial in a New Orleans courtroom. A series of scenes, Detective Lavelle argues, does not meet with reality with the real Jim Garrison.
That New Orleans scene was a complete farce. It didn't happen like that. I don't know whether you're aware of it or not, but what's his name that played Garrison?
Kevin Costner.
Costner. Incidentally, I like Costner. He was one of the nicest movie actors I've ever dealt with, and I've dealt with several. Mm-hmm. But he portrayed Garrison in that, and he was doing all that questioning. The fact is, Garrison spent less than 5 minutes in that trial. And he didn't question the witness.
The man named in the end credits of the movie as the technical advisor is Robert Grodin.
I was very, very proud to be working with Oliver Stone. His film, JFK, is extremely important. It's influenced a lot of people by giving them the knowledge of what really did happen. It brought it to life for them. And this was key.
He not only worked with Oliver Stone in making the film, he's in the movie throughout. As the man who operates the film projector when the Zapruder film is played for the jury, as one of the doctors at Parkland Hospital, and as the man making the Lee Harvey Oswald backyard photograph pieced together as Garrison, played by Costner, is building an argument while having lunch with his staff.
Was as close to reality as anybody could possibly make it. He went out of his way to just do the most minute details. Scenes that were shot in black and white, he would repaint window frames to the correct color, even if he wasn't going to show it, so it would be closer to that. He imported tons and tons of dirt to throw over the parking lot, which at the time of the assassination was not paved. It is now. So he covered all the paving up. He put in false railroad tracks the way they were actually at the time. Nobody would have noticed. Nobody would have cared. But he went to that kind of detail. And I'm very, very proud about JFK.
Oliver Stone's movie, though, was not the first of its kind. A movie came out about 10 years after the assassination called Executive Action.
Don't make your decision until you see Executive Action. Possibly the most controversial motion picture of our time.
Start the target.
A film that nobody would make until now.
Fire!
Never before in American history has one family held such an enormous concentration of political power. The plan is perfectly plain. 2 terms for JFK, 2 for Bobby, and 2 for Ted.
Which makes action now imperative.
What kind of action?
Executive.
It involved a group of businessmen who ordered the assassination. They're played by actors Burt Lancaster, Robert Ryan, and Will Geer. Similarly to Oliver Stone's JFK, it shows a shooting in Dealey Plaza where Lee Harvey Oswald was set up, and a triangulated team of gunmen placed throughout the plaza fired into the limousine with the fatal headshot coming from the front behind the picket fence on the Knoll. That movie debuted in Dallas in 1973, and the reviews were so ugly, it was scrapped. Not until the 2000s was the movie brought back to life for purchase. After JFK in the early 90s came a different approach to the same subject. Parkland set out to tell the story of the people who were affected in the immediate aftermath that weekend, the doctors, the investigators, and so on. The director was Peter Landsman.
I really went on a 3-year journey, finding witnesses, finding people who were there, the relatives of people who were there. And there's kind of strangely hidden accounts, and hidden not because they're secret, but because no one bothered looking. You know, for 50 years we've been obsessed with the murder mystery of it all and the conspiracy nonsense, really, to be honest. And, you know, the film's only agenda is to be honest and raw and deeply powerful. People who see this movie are shocked.
The movie, like Oliver Stone's, begins with the president being killed. It shows doctors trying to save his life but declaring him dead. And using witness testimony and oral history, it details the Secret Service pushing through the local officials to get back to Air Force One.
They had no idea if an invasion was happening. They had no idea if it was a coup d'etat happening. All they needed to know was needed to get the hell out of Dallas. And they rushed up that plane with a very, very heavy casket, which was about 3,000 pounds, filled with blood. And it was a brutal, brutalizing moment and reminded me of Iwo Jima, which is how I really shot it. It felt like soldiers with their hands in the casket, like their hands in the flag, just trying to get it up and keep it up.
The movie highlights the actions of one of the men I've included throughout this series, Jim Hostie.
It was all being buried. It was all being put under the ground because it was not because there were secrets or conspiracies or things being hidden. It was just too painful, too difficult, too much responsibility. We wanted to get rid of it. We wanted to get rid of Oswald's body. And, you know, Jim Hostie, one of the great tragic heroes of our time, really an amazing tragedy, just, you know, he was a beat cop trying to protect his job. And it wasn't like he was part of some larger group. He just realized that if he'd been blamed for having known about Oswald for 18 months, he'd been blamed for the assassination, as the FBI kind of did blame him.
Parkland came out around the 50th anniversary of the assassination in 2013. 3 years before that is when Landsman said he began working on the project. Also 3 years before the movie is when I spent a little over an hour with Jim Hostie himself, who had just before that spent time with the eventual producers of Parkland. He was trying to get something across to me during our conversation that I wasn't really picking up on at the time. Then when I saw the movie, I flashed back to that conversation. This here is not only in the movie itself, it's in the official trailer. The actor playing Gordon Shanklin, who Hostie says told him to destroy the note Oswald left him, is confronting Hostie about the note.
We had the assassin of the president in our office 10 days ago. We had him! And we could have stopped him!
The movie adds to what Hostie said the note was really about. There was a claim from a secretary in the office that the note Oswald left included a threat to blow up the police department. Not the FBI, but the police department, according to Hostie. So Parkland, the movie, suggests that Hostie was reprimanded for not using the threat as an excuse to arrest Oswald, which could have prevented the assassination. Now let's go back to 2010, and my conversation with Hostie about what the note said. Remember, Oswald gave the note to his secretary in the office.
She got this note for me, and I guess Oswald came in, he had a wild look in his eye, and left a note and said, "Here, give this to Hostie when he comes in." She says she took the note to the agent in charge. He looked at it and said, "Oh, there's nothing to this. Give it to Hostie when he comes in."
Hostie has said the note simply said something to the effect of, "Leave my wife alone, you talk to me," and that sort of message. Hostie claims the stories from the secretary who took the note did not stay the same.
Through the years, she's been retelling the story, and every time she retells it, it gets wilder and wilder. We have sworn statements from several FBI employees and agents, and each one said she told them a different story as what was in there. And so she was a little bit touched, I think.
And Hostie claims that the story about Oswald writing in the note that he was going to blow up the police department, again, not the FBI, but the police department, came under bizarre circumstances.
When she made the statement to the FBI inspector about blowing up the police department, now that doesn't even make sense, blow up the police department. When she gave that story, she was, at the time she was giving this statement, she was heavily under the influence of drugs. She was in the hospital. She'd just been operated on and was under heavy, heavy pain medication. And when you do that, you get rather confused sometimes. So I think that if they'd ever tried to use that statement in any kind of a trial or hearing, they'd throw it out immediately that she was under the influence of drugs. And it's right in the statement that she was operated on the previous day and she was heavily medicated. Why nobody ever picked that up, I don't know.
Hosty isn't the only main character in the movie. So is Abraham Zapruder, played by Paul Giamatti. Alexandra Zapruder enjoyed the movie's interpretation of her grandfather's story.
He did a wonderful, wonderful job of capturing the emotional turmoil that our grandfather must have felt. And, you know, it's very strange to see a famous actor play the role of someone who is in your family. But I thought it was an incredibly sympathetic portrayal, and we were all very grateful for that. I think he really captured what a traumatic moment it must have been and how our grandfather sort of handled himself in the hours following the assassination.
The portrayal of Zapruder was something important to movie director Peter Landsman when he began the project. He says it took some time for the Zapruder family to open up to him.
His story is remarkable. You know, really the story of the death of the American dream. You know, his family ran from the Holocaust. Abraham Zapruder came here from Hungary, went to school at night to scrape away his accent so he could be American. And he was really amazing. He was a flag-waving, converted immigrant American. And all destroyed by his accidental taking of this, what turned out to be a snuff film.
Landsman says his movie shows how everyday people got caught up in an extraordinary event.
How the ordinary can be so extraordinary. How ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, the stories they have to tell, are bigger than what we think of as the celebrity gloss and the mythology and the giants. You know, they're all people. And I think that audiences will see this film and be shocked and stunned by just how powerful it is. Surprised by that.
But Parkland did not have the impact that its assassination predecessor did. Oliver Stone's JFK not only made hundreds of millions of dollars, it also stunned viewers, and its aftermath led to the creation of the Assassination Records Review Board a year after the movie came out. The board looked at records related to the assassination that at that time were still considered too sensitive for public consumption. It was decided that the records would be held until at least 2017. That is what was the JFK document dump that year that declassified more documents one could imagine related to the assassination and fallout. 4 years before that, around the 50th anniversary of the assassination, former longtime curator of the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, Gary Mack, talked about it.
People wonder if there's some previously classified top secret document that explains everything. No, I don't think for a minute that anything like that is written down. According to the law, the JFK Act of 1992, which President Bush signed and President Clinton implemented 2 years later, every single withheld document must be released without exception by 2017. My understanding is there are still going to be CIA documents that will not come out, not necessarily because they are so sensitive, although that might be part of it, is that they have so many pages and they don't have enough people to really go through and make sure, well, it's this informant, if his name became known, he might be, his life might be in jeopardy, things like that. So they don't have enough people or time to process all of the remaining documents. There are other things going on in the world.
Mack wished there was a way to dump everything out on the table, a table that would probably have to be the size of the city of Dallas itself, so everything was known. And it's not just the government documents he's talking about.
I just wish there were a way to at least establish a point where everything that is known or was known is out there for evaluation. I know personally from talking to people and watching the films and photographs that are exist from Dealey Plaza that there are other photographers who've never come forward. Their names are unknown and their pictures are unknown. And what's happening today is that as these people pass on, their family or kids inherit this stuff, and not many people have an 8mm home movie projector anymore, and you know, they find a reel, it's Mark Kennedy, and they don't know what it is, and these things get thrown away. I know of a motorcade film taken out at Love Field that I was lucky enough to see, and the woman who had it told me that her son filmed Kennedy going by in the motorcade, and a week or so after that happened, he was killed in a car wreck. She could not bear to part with that film. Well, she passed away. Her other two sons inherited her things, and they threw it all out. All of her stuff they threw out. So it's gone forever. Now, that film didn't change history, but it's another visual example of one way that someone might be able to have their question answered if they could see the film. But now that's not going to happen.
The document dump happened in 2017. Some of the files were held back. Then another dump came a little bit later. Well, what did we learn? I'd say we learned a lot and absolutely nothing. There were a couple thick memos that detailed assassination plots around the world that had been thought up by the CIA. A British newspaper got a heads up about something big happening in the United States right before the assassination happened. Other things that perhaps had already been out there, but now the document is not redacted at all. I'd say a whole lot of little things that didn't really add up to a different stack of a whole lot of little things that didn't really add up to another stack, and on and on and on. But Oliver Stone's movie, that's considered the godfather of all assassination movies 26 years prior, is what I credit for the eventual release of the files. And they're available to you right now. Here's the website, archives.gov/research/JFK/release. Nearly 1,100 pages, each of them filled with individual downloadable documents. The Kennedy assassination had its share of victims. I'm not just talking about President Kennedy and Officer Tippit and the suspect and others. Abraham Zapruder was a victim. So traumatized, he never used that film camera again. Jim Hostey, a victim, blamed for things completely outside of his control. The doctors, the reporters, and so on. But there is another victim we haven't even touched on yet, and it's a big one. Big D. The city of Dallas. Nicknamed for a time, the City of Hate. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas.